Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio. Callum Stoneman back with you again for our weekly show discussing anything and everything related to technology from a blind and partially sighted perspective. If you want to get in contact with the show, you're more than welcome to. You can drop us an email or attach a voice message to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk at rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, we'll be finding out all about FlowType, the iOS keyboard app designed for blind users. We'll be discovering the social media platform Letterboxd, which allows you to share your taste in movies. And also, we'll be talking cybersecurity with one of our listeners right up my street. I'm looking forward to that one. The usual co-hosts with me this week, Hubert Pavalkovich, Jackie Brown and Natalie Curran. Let's see what's been going on. Hubert, anything grabbed your attention this week?
An interesting one. So I'm a Mac user and I like using it. I think it's brilliant. But there's certain tasks that sometimes Windows does better, such as word processing, for example, and then, you know, using the Microsoft Office applications on Windows. I think it just works really well. The reason I mention this is because you can technically run a virtual style Windows experience on a Mac, but it's always been a bit fiddly. But a new virtual machine has been designed by a blind developer where it's a very accessible virtual machine where you can run a virtual Windows experience. So you can casually switch to Windows for the tasks that you want to do that are better on Windows, but still switch back to the Mac if you're someone that prefers using a Mac. I've not set it up yet, but I have found it and downloaded it onto my Mac. It's another GitHub job, unfortunately. So if you Google accessible virtual machine, that tends to come up straight away on the top of your search results, and then you have to download the latest release. And the good thing is, from the latest release, it will update automatically rather than you having to download every single new update manually through the GitHub website.
Yeah, I used to use Windows on my Mac. This isn't so much the case nowadays with the Microsoft Surface range, I don't think, but it used to be a bit of a half joke that the best experience of Windows was on a Mac, because the hardware is so good.
I mean, it's an interesting experience. Yeah. It is quite a techie experience, but sometimes it's easier than having, you know, maintaining two different laptops when it's actually doing this. On paper, at least, sounds much easier, but, you know, how that will come in practice, I'll have to set it up first. But, you know, I've heard good things about it.
Well, it sounds good anyway. Let us know how you get on with that. Jackie, anything from you?
Yes. The Meta AI app is playing silly beggars at the moment, I think. I don't know if any of you or anyone listening to this program has encountered this, but I don't use my glasses every day. Sometimes I don't even use them once in a week. But I did put them on recently, and I discovered the app was really acting weird. It wanted to know, first of all, what country I was in. Then I couldn't bypass this unless I went to Learn More button. And when I got into the Learn More button, that enabled me then to get out of it. I went, I think, from there into settings, and I was able then to update. There was an update for my glasses, so I did the update. But it seems to me, I don't know if any of you feel the same, but every time I seem to open the Meta AI app, there is something different about the layout or something it wants. There's sometimes an edit box and I'm never quite sure what information it's looking for. It just feels quite a faff lately. I'm just beginning to get really irritated with it.
I'm similar, I must admit. I haven't used my Meta glasses in a while. I took them on holiday with me because I thought, I was on holiday last week and I thought maybe I'd use them there, but as it turns out, I didn't end up using them. So they've not been used for maybe like 2 weeks. And I put them on actually yesterday, funnily enough. And then I just asked Meta AI to recognize something for me. And it took the picture and did the little, like, you know, that it does when it's processing. And then it went, based on your location, it looks like Meta AI can help you with that. To turn it on, because, and I'm thinking, well, first off, it is on. Secondly, why did you take the picture? Like, why bother taking the picture to then go, oh, yeah, I can help you with that. Right? Okay. Right? Yeah, I had to go in and turn off Meta AI and then turn it back on. But yeah, you're right. Trying to find that. There's a big push to use Meta AI as your chatbot, I think is what's going on. So all over it, I couldn't find the glasses settings. It's more chats and create images and vibes, whatever they are. I don't have a clue what vibes are on there, but there seems to be a big push for them.
So annoying. Every time, though, that these days you seem to... Because as I say, I'm not a daily or even a weekly user. You know, I get them out if I want to look at something and get it to recognize something when it's hands free, because I do think that's really useful to be able to do that. But I don't know, of late, that the app feels just so convoluted and constantly updating. You can never find things, and it just takes you as long to find something that works in the app than it does to actually just hold your phone up, take a picture with Be My Eyes or something.
I wish they'd have just kept it as a companion app for the glasses, or at least just separated it out into something else. Again, while I was away, because I was away with family, and my nan, who is not technical in the slightest, she has Facebook, and she said to me, this pop-up keeps coming up, and it says you and a few other people are on it, because she is, no matter how many warnings you give, she doesn't listen to this, so I can get away with it. She is one of these people who, if something comes in or if a link comes in or whatever, she'll just click it, you know, and she'll have a look and see. Yeah. So she says, this app keeps coming up and it says you're on it. So I'm thinking, okay, what is this? I said, give us it here. She showed me, and it did. It said Callum Stoneman, and listed a few of her other friends and stuff are on the app that knows you best. And I'm honestly thinking, what the hell is this? Because, like, it does have my real details. Clicked it. It threw her to the app store. And sure enough, it was Meta AI that it wanted her to download. And I'm thinking, why? This is just for my glasses. Why do you need to tell everyone that I'm...
Very intrusive,
yeah.
I think.
The app is rather convoluted. I think the glasses have almost become a very much a background feature of this app. And it focuses, like, I don't want to do 5,000 things with my pictures.
Yes.
I just want to take a photo and be able to access it. I don't want to make me look like a reindeer or something like that. I just want to access them.
Yeah.
Natalie, anything from you this week?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's another techie one on the back of Hubert's. But it's something that a colleague at work brought up, and I thought, this sounds interesting. I don't know if you've ever used predictive text or shortcuts. I know I've mentioned it before on my iPhone that in moments of deep boredom, I have gone into settings and wired in a load of shortcuts, particularly mapped to Braille contractions to try and speed up typing, and I do use them a lot. But I've never really done it on my laptop. And it's something a colleague mentioned that you can do. And I thought, yeah, I know about this. It's a thing called Blocks, but it's a bit faffy and it doesn't work everywhere and you forget where it is, blah, 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 blah. But what he was describing was something different. And it is basically an autocorrect thing, exactly like it is on the iPhone keyboard feature. So you can go into, I'd say a Word document, because Word document I think is the simplest, but you can do it in any Microsoft app. You go into File, and then you go to Options, which is right down the bottom, or if you arrow up the way it's back the way. And then click on that, and then you go, it should open up a list of submenu options like General, Spelling, Proofing, Trust Center, all these different things. You go into Proofing, and then it's literally one of the first two or three options, and it says like add autocorrect or something like that, and you click that, and just like in the keyboard settings on an iPhone or an iPad, you have your two boxes, one for whatever the long message is and one for the abbreviation you want to use. You hit OK, you save that, you come, I think you press OK on the wee window. I would press OK on the actual main tab as well. And then you come out of that. And what will happen is when you type in that shortcut and then hit space, it will autofill, but it will autofill on any Microsoft platform. So Word, email, sorry, Outlook, Excel, PowerPoint, whatever. And I thought, this is really useful because certainly with emails, I find myself writing some of the same stuff over and over and over again. So the first one I put in is link text instructions. I hate a URL. So I've got a policy now at work that if somebody sends me an email with a URL in it, I will not reply to the email. I will reply saying, please resend that with link text and here's how. Because wow. I have taken it on as a personal crusade. I hate the things. But yes, I thought it was very useful. And actually, if I'm honest, I'm thinking of putting in the word accessibility because I don't know how many times I write that in a day, never mind a week. And I don't know how many times I write that wrong in a day, never mind a week.
Yeah.
So yes, I thought that was one I would mention. So it's file, options, proofing, and then autocorrect is the option you want.
And that's in any Microsoft app, you can go to that.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice. I'm going to look at that.
Wow.
They are cool, these shortcuts. I've got a few on my phone. And there's a few more that I keep meaning to add, but I just never get around to it. I still think what you've done with Braille contractions is genius, by the way.
Thank you.
So I would never have thought of that. So here's something I discovered while I was away. I've mentioned before about how my I've now got access to Google Gemini for Home, which means that my cameras, because I've got Google Home doorbell, they get kind of richer descriptions of what's going on. So rather than saying like motion scene at the front door, it might say like a person walks towards the camera holding a package, something like that. Or one of our neighbours the other week was brought the bins in for us and it said a person approaches the house pushing a wheelie bin.
That's useful.
It is, yeah. But you get more of a kind of just feel of what's going on. It's not your tip. It's not your, like, be my eyes description, you know, but it's better than just someone's there.
Yeah.
It now takes audio into account as well as part of that description. So if it hears something noteworthy, or that might be noteworthy, it kind of mentions that as well. And the way I discovered this was I'm there on holiday. I've left my phone in the room because, you know, I don't really need it. I'm on holiday. I want to switch off from the world as much as I can. So we're out for a bit. I get back to the room, check my phone, and there's a notification there from Google Home that says, a person walks towards the door, glass breaking heard. And I knew, like, that notification had come through a while ago, and we've got an alarm, and the, you know, burglar alarm hadn't gone off. None of the neighbours had tried to get in touch or anything like that. So I'm like, it wasn't an instant panic kind of thing, but I am a bit like, what the hell's gone on there? So I listened to it. What it was, we'd got a few items of post, so it was the clunking of the letterbox that it had heard. When you listen to it, you're kind of like, I listened to it, I was like, yeah, do you know what? I can kind of see that. I suppose it could sound a bit like glass, you know, someone trying to break glass, but even still, I'm like, well, it's good that it does that, but it's not the best statistical AI. It's not the best start. Yeah, it's not a great start.
It'd be good if you could teach it.
That's
if you could
what
say
I'm
back
thinking.
To it, that wasn't glass breaking, that was a letterbox. Yeah. If you hear that again, it's fine.
I mean, there's other stuff where I wouldn't say it's been useful yet, but there has been other stuff that it's picked up on, which I found kind of interesting. You know, the things that it thinks are noteworthy. I think we were coming out of the house the other day and James, my son, he's only two, he was doing something. He was having as toddlers do, you know, he was having a bit of a whinge. And it picked that up. It said, like, you know, because it does facial recognition as well. So it said, like, Cal and Jess seen child crying heard. So again, I thought, well, that, you know, that could be useful. Then there's the other side of the scale, because it doesn't do it all the time. It only tells you about audio if it thinks it's relevant. So again, I suppose, you know, child crying could be relevant. Glass breaking definitely is. But then, I can't believe I'm saying this. I stepped out of the house the other day to put something in the bin. And this is ridiculous. I sneezed while I was out there, which I thought nothing of. And then I got a notification on my phone. Callum put something in a bin. Sneeze heard. I thought, oh, for God's sake. Do you really need to tell me that?
Yeah.
Like, out of all the things. But, I mean, it's a typical AI thing. I guess this is why everything is beta nowadays.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an interesting feature to have. How useful it's going to prove to be. I mean, I'm sure it'll get better over time.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I do kind of wish they'd tell us about these things, though, rather than just getting a notification that says glass breaking is heard. If you've got access to Gemini for Home, then keep an eye out for that, because that sort of thing might be coming and it might be useful for you. All right, well, a lot going on this week, as always. Stick with us. This is Tech Talk. A cool little app has been developed and is in beta, which has got a lot of people talking. You might have heard me mention this in our little tech radar a couple of weeks ago, the little bit of chat that we do before we start properly. It's an app called Flowtype, and it's an app to basically just help you type faster on the iOS on-screen keyboard. And I'm joined now by Rocco Fiorentino, the developer of the app, to tell us a bit more. Welcome to Tech Talk, Rocco. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, I mean, I described it briefly then, but I'm sure you'll be able to describe it a lot better than me. Do you want to tell us a bit about Flowtype and what it is?
Yeah, so Flowtype is essentially a more efficient way for blind or low vision users of iOS to type on the screen. I think we've all kind of gotten used to or know of all of the ways that you can do that on a touchscreen in general and in Apple. And all of them aren't really that great, right? You can either like tap a letter and then double tap it to insert it, and you have to keep tap, double tap, tap, double tap every time you type. Or you can, you know, hold your finger on the screen and let go when you find the letter that it is that you want. And then you have the direct touch version, which is essentially just like turning VoiceOver completely off, and, you know, whatever letter you touch is the letter that goes into the text box. And none of them are really that great, right? Like, it makes me want to just kind of use like dictation or Braille screen input or, you know, whatever. And even that I don't love. And so, you know, when Flexi and later Flicktype came, that I think was the first time that I really loved typing on a flat touchscreen before. It was the thing that made the most sense to me and was the most efficient that I had seen. And then that kind of went away, you know, in 2021. And it never really came back. And I kind of just waited for something to happen or someone to pick it up, and no one really did. And so I finally went, you know, what if I try and do that? And so here we are.
Well, I was going to ask about that, because I remember Flexi and then Flicktype back in the day, and they were fantastic apps. I used to absolutely love Flexi. I mean, it was mind-blowing when that came along. So the idea of this app, and I don't want to say it copies it, because that feels really harsh, but the core of it, like the core gestures and the core way of typing, is pretty much the same. So is that, I guess you've already kind of answered it, but is that where the idea came from to bring this back?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't necessarily trying to copy an app like identically, right? But also, there are only so many ways that a keyboard can be a keyboard, right? Like, any third-party keyboard has to have letters, has to have a backspace button, you know, like you can only, you know, do that stuff. So so many different ways. And I think the kind of core idea of Flexi and FlickType, which were kind of one and the same, was the thing that I missed, and the thing that was sort of the gap that was left by them being gone and kind of unusable, you know, since the keyboard extension was discontinued, and now since Flexi is also gone. So yeah, I just kind of took inspiration from that and used that as the foundation, and then tried to build upon that foundation and you know, sort of modernize it, and at least allow people who were used to that typing experience to kind of have that as a baseline and then build upon.
So do you want to just give us a bit of a description of how it actually works, like the experience of typing on it?
Sure. So essentially, the whole premise of the keyboard is that you don't need to be accurate when you type. When you're typing letters, VoiceOver doesn't give you feedback as you're typing. It just gives you either haptics or sounds or both, depending on how you have it set up, to tell you that, like, hey, a letter is being registered, but it doesn't actually tell you what the letter is. And that's on purpose, because the whole point is to tap where you think the letters would be on a regular QWERTY keyboard, at least for now, in English. I am very much planning to add other languages and multi-language support in the future. But I want to kind of get the English version working, you know, as the best that it can, and get all the bugs kind of ironed out, and then start adding other languages. Because if I do that before I'm ready, all the bugs that are in English are going to translate to the other languages.
Yeah.
yeah. So sure. On the QWERTY keyboard, that's kind of the premise, right? You can tap where you think the letters are. You swipe right when you're done typing the word, and FlowType will give you what it thinks is its best sort of match of that word, right? And if that's not the match, you can swipe down or up through a list of essentially suggestions that, you know, are close to the letters that you the position of the letters that you tapped, and then you just keep typing. So you can kind of get really fast in that way. And once you're done typing a sentence or whatever, or if you want a comma or a period, you can swipe right again, and it will give you all that punctuation, and that kind of thing. So that's kind of the main way that works. And swiping left will delete, words or characters, depending on how you have things set.
Yeah. And that's another thing with this, is that the customizability that you've built in. Because, I mean, pretty much every setting can be customized as well, right?
I try to do that, yeah. I think it's kind of funny, because, like, I try not to make, like, too many settings, because I don't, you know, I think sometimes it gets a little cluttered when you have, you know, 30 categories and 30 yeah. things inside those. And, you know, so I try to be mindful of that, but I also try to kind of balance that to where I know that, you know, people like different sounds, people like different color schemes if you have low vision, you know, and so I try to allow you to sort of personalize the keyboard as much as what makes sense, so that it's you know, doing what you want it to do, and it's a good experience for you. So I'll just kind of do a little demo of this, because I think it's easiest when you kind of almost like show and tell instead of explain and tell.
Yeah.
So I'm inside of FlowType now, and I'm going to type the word hello. And you'll notice nothing happens, right? You just get taps, but there's no speech as I'm typing. So I think the if anyone has never used it before, the first thing people do is go like, oh, like something's broken. It's not telling me the letters, right?
Yeah.
But it's actually not supposed to yet, because the whole premise of this is that you're able to tap where you think the letters are in the, you know, QWERTY position of them on the screen, and FlowType guesses based on your taps and how close you are to a given letter, what word you're trying to write. So Now that I've typed that out, I'm going to swipe right, and it's going to give me what it thinks I wanted.
Hello.
Cool. H-E-L-L-O. So that's obviously correct. I'm going to slow my speech down real quick.
Words. Beam 80%. 75, 70, 65%, 60%, 55%.
Okay. And I'm going to just, once you are done with a word or it's the correct one, you can just keep typing the next one. Flowtype will deal with spacing automatically for you. So I'm going to write I'm. Swipe right.
I apostrophe M.
Cool.
Cap I apostrophe M.
And I happen to have my spelling thing on, so it will spell out each word as I'm typing, which you can turn off in settings. But a lot of times if you're typing, I don't know, things like no and no, you know, whatever. Sometimes you need to know the spelling of the, you know, than and
yeah.
Then, you know, sometimes VoiceOver isn't very articulate when it's saying words. So it's helpful to do that. But you can do that with gestures too. You don't have to spell every word. So right now, like, for example, I'm going to do a four-finger tap, and it will read back what's currently in the text field.
Hello, I'm.
So, hello, I'm typing.
Typing. T-Y-P-I-N-G. Using.
And so far,
U-S-I-N-G.
I've gotten the right word every time I've swiped right.
Yeah.
Right? This.
This.
And
T-H-I-S.
I'm going to write app, but I'm going to purposely not tap where I think the P is. The P's are A-P-P. Swipe right.
All.
Okay, so I got A-L-L. All this time because my finger was too low where the P is supposed to be, right? So now I'm going to swipe down.
App. A-P-P.
And now I got the word that I want. Called.
Called.
Flow type.
Flow type. Period.
Period. So I swiped right again after I've entered the word, and now I get punctuation. So if I swipe down,
comma, question mark, exclamation mark,
I can do that. So that's kind of just a quick, kind of dirty demo of how the app works.
It's just, for me, it's those clicks as you're typing. You get those clicks. I feel like a sighted person, you know, when you sit there and there's, you know, when there's a sighted yeah. person next to you and you've got...
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the goal, you know, is to level the playing field, because you can really, you know, type pretty quickly.
This is a yeah test of clear taps. B flow type app period period smiling face.
So, you know, you can get going pretty quick if you type that way. And I generally tend to type with one finger.
Yeah.
But I mean, there are people that have done this in landscape mode or on iPad or whatever, and they'll just go
two.
You know, you can get pretty quick. And so, you know, so I think one of the things that a few people have told me is like, oh, I type too fast and it can't, you know, recognize, it misses a tap or two because I'm typing so fast. And I'm like, wow. Like, so that's something I need to look at. But at the moment of recording this, this app is still in beta.
It is fantastic. I mean, you've kind of answered this in the excitement in your voice, but I think it's just worth saying with apps like this, like, you're visually impaired yourself and you're using this on a daily basis. And I know you built it, but it sounds like you're absolutely loving it.
I do really enjoy it. I mean, I am totally blind. And so I really, that's why I built this, right? Because I felt the gap. I missed that typing experience, and I really wanted to see if I could recreate it and then kind of add to it and just make it better and kind of bring it back. And, you know, for a second, I kind of thought like, well, okay, maybe I'll just play with this on my own phone and see, you know, how far I get. And then I went, you know, I think I should share this, you know, because why not? Like, why only keep the fun for myself, right? And so, yeah, I really have enjoyed developing it and playing with it and fixing bugs and seeing the feedback from the community just from the beta has been really incredible, and something that I don't think I quite expected. You know, I've had people email me and say, like, you know, I'm only able to use, you know, one of my hands or one of my arms, and, you know, this has, you know, changed my life, and you know, that kind of, and that's really special to me. The amount of people it has reached in varying countries is amazing to me. I'm very humbled and very just amazed at how it's reached thus far, and it's not even on the App Store yet.
Well, this is it. It's amazing how far these things travel sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Possibly a bit of a technical question. I don't know if you'd want to give away your secrets, but how are you handling the predictions? Because it is unbelievably accurate. And when I go back to, for me personally, when I go back to the standard keyboard, I'm thinking, you can't be using Apple's autocorrect, surely.
No, Apple doesn't even really let you use their, like, predictive autocorrect stuff in third-party keyboards, which is interesting. You can use, like, AI, like the Apple Intelligence and stuff like that. But
yeah.
Yeah, their actual, like, autocorrect engine is kind of locked out to third-party developers, at least from what I can, from what I've found. Maybe I'm missing something, but I mean, the actual, like, under the hood stuff that's going on is fairly complicated, actually, like, more than you'd expect. And it really does try to be as accurate as it can. It does kind of learn over time as you type. So, for example, if your I sort of refer to it as, like, high tappers and low tappers, right? So if you tend to tap higher on the screen than where the actual keyboard sits, where the actual keys are. So if you want to type the letter H and you actually type closer to, like, where the letter Y is, right? Or the opposite, you want to type the letter H but you type closer to where the B is underneath, or in between or whatever, FlowType will learn those things about your typing patterns over time, and be able to adapt to them in real time. So, you know, accuracy will be as good as it can be the first time you use it, but the more that you use it, the more that accuracy should feel better and get better, and just sort of adapt to your own typing style and your tapping patterns, over time. And all of that adaptation and sort of typing pattern memory is all local and on device. It's not getting sent to a cloud or being processed or any of that. It's all just locally running code that doesn't go anywhere.
So as you mentioned, this is still in beta at the minute at the time of recording, but if people want to test this out and provide feedback, how can they get hold of the app and how can they get in touch with you as well?
Yeah. So FlowType has its own little website. It is flowtype.app. So flowtype.app/beta. That slash beta link will take you directly to either TestFlight, to the App Store to grab it. If you already have TestFlight installed, it will take you directly to the install page for FlowType. If you go to flowtype.app in general, that's just sort of the website for the app, and you can get to beta there as well. But that'll just kind of take you to, like, a landing page. And then, of course, when it actually comes out into the App Store, you'll be able to download it from Apple there and also from that site.
Fantastic. Well, it's a great app. I wish you all the best with it. And keep in touch. Yeah, we'd love to hear how this develops.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rocco Fiorentino, the developer of Floatype there. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You are listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and it's time to dive into our weekly sight loss story feature, where we talk to blind and partially sighted people all about their sight loss journeys and what got them to where they are today. So this week we are speaking to Daniel Sykes, who was born with Stickler syndrome and who now works for the police. But we're going to find out exactly what Daniel does as he joins us now. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Can you tell us, first of all, a bit more about your sight condition, please?
Of course. So I was born with something called Stickler syndrome. It's a very rare genetic disorder impacting, I believe, 1 in 10,000 or so. But essentially, when I was born, I essentially had a retinal detachment, and I was one of the youngest babies at the time to ever have something like this. So I was rushed into hospital. Well, I was born in a hospital, but I was rushed to another hospital, and I've had extensive surgery on my eyes, and there is an amazing surgeon named Dr. Schulenberg. I believe he's retired now, but he was able to save, and his team, to save a large portion of my eyesight at the time. But unfortunately, my eyes are quite bad still. I've got I'm virtually all blind in my entire right eye, and I have I think minus 16 or so on my left eye. So I'm not able to drive. But that being said, I've had a very fulfilling life in spite of my disability.
Now, when it comes to adapting to life with sight loss, being born with it, there's always a bit of a difference to it because you have to adapt from day one. But when you were adapting to life with sight loss, what did you find helped you the most, and what was the most helpful?
The more human things actually made the biggest difference. Now, growing up, I had things like enlarged print at school. Teachers would help me a little bit more in my primary school years. But eventually my parents realized that the support I was getting wasn't sufficient because of my disability. And they actually moved me to a specialist school that had a visually impaired unit. It was George Abbott High School at the time, and they had this unit there for partially sighted and visually impaired pupils. And it was great. The resources there were amazing. So I could be in class and there would be a teaching assistant sat next to me who would transcribe what was on the board. They would help me access lesson material. And there was all kinds of value from my time in the visually impaired unit. But also probably the most notable thing, this quite links into what I do for work, is how I got into tech. So naturally, as a visually impaired person, I wasn't too good at school sports. I always struggled playing football and all these kind of things. And during my primary school years, me and my family had an agreement at the school that rather than doing PE or sports, I would learn how to touch type. And every single week, my grandma would come into the school and teach me how to type on a keyboard. And it was through that little one afternoon, once a week, that I just embraced technology, and I began to realize that digital solutions can provide all kinds of support for someone like me. And I immersed myself in computers, and I love video games and all these kind of things. And that was the biggest kind of moment for me, I think, understanding that I was able to engage with the world. I just had to adapt the way in which I did that.
I want to talk a little bit about your technology interests, especially because of the line of work you got into. So I'd like to tackle two of these things in one. Can you tell us how you got into what your job today and what exactly you do?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a cyber protect officer for Surrey and Sussex Police. And essentially what I do is I provide free and bespoke cybersecurity awareness training to any organization or community group. The idea is that cybercrime costs the UK economy about 0.5% of GDP every single year, or 27 billion a year. Numbers get thrown around quite a lot. But the idea of Cyber Protect is that we're trying to make a dent in that figure and try and keep people safe against cyber criminals before they become a victim. So that's what I do. Now, I joined policing about 8 years ago now. It's been a while. But my story of going into it, I'd link back to my father. So my dad is a retired detective sergeant. He worked at the Metropolitan Police. And I always had this family link to policing. And I went to university when I was 18, 19, and I studied history, of all things, which is completely unrelated to what I do now. But I wanted to join the police force when I got back. And because of my eyesight and visual impairment, I wasn't able to join as an officer like my father did. But that being said, there was an opportunity to join as police staff. And I don't know how I managed to fluff my way through the interview, but essentially I got my first job with the police. It was like an IT project management role. And I did that for a number of years. Eventually, you know, I did that for a few years. COVID happened, and I began to see that, you know, there's a lot of stories about cybercrime in the news. I was seeing cases of ransomware attacks. We can get into that later on, about what cyber criminals were doing. And I was like, wow, this is a quite an interesting area of policing that I want to be a part of. And I applied for my current job over 5 years ago now, and I didn't get it. But I knew I wouldn't get it because I had no cybersecurity experience. But I figured, like, I'll go down FISIC anyway. That's what I did. So I applied anyway. I just bombarded all the knowledge I could possibly get from a few nights of just cramming at the interview. And the interviewers seemed to like my my passion for it and actually offered me a voluntary job. So I did kind of what I do now voluntarily for about a year, part-time in concurrence of my other job in the police. And then when my predecessor left a year later, I had that foot in the door, and so I was able to get the full-time job. So that's how I got into where I am now. And sometimes, you know, failure can be a ladder if you utilize it the right way. But naturally, you know, in this area of policing, it's an area where my eyesight, you know, it becomes an asset, my disability, because I think about things in different ways. And when you're in a public-facing role, I've got to connect with audiences. And audiences have all kinds of accessibility needs and different requirements. And my adaptions made me think about how I can adapt my content for other people as well.
How do you link accessibility and assistive technology with cybersecurity? How do you link these sort of passions together?
I think that it depends entirely on the equipment and the habits of the person. So I know many visually impaired people and blind people that will use screen readers. Some of them use Braille. It really does depend on the person. But what I would say, though, is I actually think in the case of cybercrime or scams, I think that visually impaired people have a slight advantage in the sense that I don't speak for all visually impaired people, but I read text word by word. So I've got some very strong reading glasses and I can read kind of large font and email because I magnify the screen. When I'm reading emails, I'm usually scanning it word by word rather than looking at a holistic picture. And when we actually see how cybercriminals get into online accounts, often it's what we call phishing or dodgy links, people clicking on things. And if you're scanning things word by word, you have a greater propensity of really thinking about the words that you're actually seeing. And you can kind of notice more subtleties like, oh, that thing's spelled incorrectly. You know, this link doesn't look quite right. And so I actually think that, you know, visually impaired people have a bit of an advantage in that space. But naturally, it doesn't depend entirely on the equipment that you use. And I like to think that if you're taking more time to access material, as a lot of people with accessibility needs do, they're more likely to spot scams than maybe their able-sighted peers.
That's quite an interesting point because, like you say, you notice a lot of these kind of dodgy spellings, dodgy grammar. It's always a common theme of phishing emails. Hmm. Are there any other kind of cybersecurity risks where blind and partially sighted people maybe have a bit of an advantage of?
In terms of advantage, I think that the key message there is that just being careful of what you see, which I think visually impaired people are naturally going to be more inclined to do. But I would say that be careful of impersonations. I mean, one of the things that cyber criminals will do is they'll impersonate trusted organizations. It could be, you know, the NHS, for example, and this is just for more broad phishing attacks. And they'll say, you know, this is the NHS, you know, your medical data is going to be deleted unless you click on this link, for example. And they'll try and threaten you. There's loads of ways that you can spot these kind of things, but you know, my quick tips for phishing, really, first of all, if it's unexpected, you never ever assume, always verify. The vast majority of scams and phishing links that you receive, there'll be some form of it'll be usually very unexpected, and there'll be some form of urgency because criminals don't want you to think. So what they're likely going to do is they're going to say, hello Bob or Alan or whatever, you know, you're due to pay X amount of money to HMRC. If you don't do it by tomorrow, you're going to be arrested. Like, these are the kind of tactics that criminals will use. But other things that you can do is look at spelling and the grammar. So often the criminals that do this, they're often based abroad and they don't have a good command of the English language as someone who lives in the UK would do. So you often find that their command of the English language is a little bit informal at times. Lots of spelling errors, typos potentially. general greeting. They could say, dear sir or madam, dear trustee. These are the kind of things that spot them. But also looking at the email address is really powerful as well. So if you do receive a supposed email from the RNIB, you can just have a look at that email address. And does it actually say RNIB? Does it actually say NHS.net or whatever it is? And because if it says NH519@hotmail.com, it's not the NHS. But looking at that email address is really important as well. And going back to what you said earlier, like adaptive tech can be very good at spotting these things. Because if you're being audibly read the email address, like most people don't even look at the email address in the things that they receive. Having it read out to you does make you stop and think a little bit more.
The question I have for you when it comes to these risks, you know, modern technology these days, okay, it improves life for blind and partially sighted people. You get a lot of AI features that can provide image descriptions and things like that, which are great, absolutely. And, you know, we talk about them all the time here on RNIB Connect Radio. But what I was wondering is, AI is also helping scammers and cyber criminals to be more sophisticated. Now, you know, blind and partially sighted people will be concerned about that. What advice would you have for them based on that kind of risk?
Well, we don't have access to all of the crime reports ever. There's a lot of people that don't report cybercrime. So I think there's a gap in intelligence there. But what I will say is that just from what I engage with anecdotally, we're not seeing criminals use AI en masse for bespoke cybercrime. We're often seeing criminals use AI the kind of same way that we might use AI to streamline and improve processes for what we already do, for example. So writing emails, doing some menial tasks for us. That's how we're seeing criminals use AI. Predominantly, our core messages on how to spot scams haven't changed all that much, because so much about how you can stay safe online comes down to your mindset rather than a set of technical skills. But on the AI threat vectors, as we call them, the new things are being introduced are essentially deepfakes or impersonations. So one of the things that AI can do is it can clone voices. So you might get cases of celebrities who have a huge precedent of their voice, right? Because if you're a movie star, you've got all kinds of films, you've got interviews, there's a huge amount of data of your voice, and AI can clone celebrities quite effectively. So the kind of things that I'm seeing anecdotally is where criminals have impersonated, like Keanu Reeves, for example, or Elon Musk, and they'll say, here's a new amazing cryptocurrency scheme, you know, this is me, the celebrity, buy into it now. The key thing is just knowing what AI can do. They're the key messages for safety. Do you know that AI can create artificially generated voices? Like if you hear a distorted voice that claims to be Elon Musk or whatever, you're going to think twice if you know that AI can do these things. But the other thing as well is essentially where criminals can superimpose someone's face in another context. That's known as a deep fake. And one of the things that we often see is trusted financial figures in the UK, someone like Martin Lewis, who's not an endorsement, but he is a generally regarded in the UK as a trusted financial voice. And criminals often will use his likeness and superimpose some kind of context or play a distortion of his voice and get him to promote cryptocurrency scams. But it's not him. It's entirely fake. So it always comes back to that core message of never assuming the things that you see and always verify. But yeah, there's all kinds of amazing things that AI can do to improve the lives of visually impaired people and also spot scams as well.
I want to move on to something less scary and kind of a little bit about how, you know, something like a quick checklist, really, of the things that blind and partially sighted people, especially those who use technology on a regular basis, could and I'd argue should do to keep themselves safe on a daily basis. What are the sort of few quick things you'd recommend that you should always really make sure you do to keep yourself safe online and using technology in general?
I think be careful of phone calls. So if you're receiving a phone call and someone says it's your bank and your screen reader, or you can see on this phone screen that it says the exact same number that your bank might call you on, don't assume trust, because criminals can spoof numbers that would be the exact same number that your bank would call you on. So that's a core message, really. And, you know, what I always like to say to people is that if your bank, quote unquote, calls you, always hang up, dial the number at the back of your card, or you can dial 159, which is a directory service that will get you through to a bank safely. But phone scams, you know, they're the, you've all seen them, phone scams, or heard them. You know, it's hard to get away from them sometimes. But what I would suggest is that if you're being inundated with them, speak to your network provider and just say, you know, we're being swarmed by scam calls. What are you going to do about it? Because some providers have very good systems which can mitigate the number of or volume of scam calls that you also receive. But one of the things that we actually offer as well, and you can get these from Trading Standards for free, for vulnerable people and not necessarily people with sight loss, but for people that we feel or they feel that they wouldn't be able to detect what's fraudulent and what's not, there are physical devices called TrueCall devices. They just clip onto a landline or a mobile phone, and they will automatically screen out the majority of scam calls and rogue traders. But that's for phone lines. But with online safety, I think, again, the core message, never assume, always verify. Never assume, always verify. When you're looking at things online, always ask yourself, you know, is this unexpected? Is there poor grammar? Is it a general greeting? Is there a sense of urgency? Criminals like to pressure you. That is the core thing to understand, is that so much of how to stay safe online comes down to your mindset. You know, if someone wants you to do a transaction of some kind and you're a little bit nervous about it, you go straight to your bank, because banks can actually be very useful in cancelling rogue transactions and storing money. And also, you know, don't feel like you need to suffer in silence. You know, if you think that you've been the victim of a fraud, of course, we always want you to report it to the police, and you can report that at Report Fraud, which is a website, and they've got a phone number as well. But before you even report it to us, you know, if you think you've been the victim of a scam, you go straight to your bank. Banks are very good now at freezing transactions and restoring money and stolen funds. But the caveat to that is that if you're trading in cryptocurrency, you have limited safety nets. And, you know, I can't give people financial advice, but I would say that any person listening here, be very, very cautious if you're investing in cryptocurrency, because you may not have the safety nets that a bank could offer you.
I will ask you the final question in a minute, but if there's anywhere people can go to get more safety advice or maybe read more articles on online safety, you know, what resource would you point them to?
So we have a website. So I'm part of a regional police cybercrime unit. So I'm from Surrey and Sussex Police, but we work as part of a broader team across the southeast. And our website is called Southeast Cyber. It should come up on Google. But also you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm Daniel Sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. And we have all kinds of resources and stuff on our LinkedIn pages that we use professionally. So we've got all kinds of tools. One of the great ones I like to promote today is everything that we do is all for free, but it's called Police Cybercheck, and it's an online toolkit that's designed to hold your hand through all these steps of how to enable strong passwords, for example, passkeys, you know, spot phishing emails. These are the core cyber behaviors that we like people to adopt. And Cybercheck is designed to explain these things in plain English for people. And, you know, the screen can be magnified. And it's a very new product, and we're working on how we can make it more accessible for different audiences. And I've got ongoing conversations at the moment with RNIB to see if we can develop a more bespoke package.
Based on your own journey and your own experiences of adapting to life with sight loss, what would your message be to blind and partially sighted people who are new to sight loss themselves and who want to adapt to life with sight loss? What advice would you give to them?
I think there's an infinite number of ways that people can break down their abilities and what they can't do. And for me, I've always seen sight loss as part of who I am, part of my DNA. And I have other benefits that maybe counteract the sight loss. You know, I think human beings are incredibly complex. You know, whilst we may be visually impaired, there's other people that have other kinds of disabilities. And I like to think that my visual impairment has made me the man I am today. And should I ever have the option of having perfect eyesight, I don't think I would. And you know, I don't speak for all visually impaired people, but I know a number of them I have spoken with do say similar things, because it forms somewhat so much of your identity. And for me, at least, I found that because of my accessibility needs, it has made me somewhat tenacious. I feel like I've got this drive in me to overcome barriers, and I feel more satisfied because, like, whenever I achieve something, I feel, oh, I've done this in spite of my disability. And I find that incredibly rewarding. But also, you know, it builds up just a sense of resilience as well. So I think that would be my core message, is that don't feel like you can't do anything in life just because of your visual impairment. And, you know, I think we're called upon to do what we can with what we have. And whilst you may be visually impaired, you may have all kinds of amazing things to offer the world. And you know, your eyesight shouldn't be the thing that stops you from doing that.
That is fantastic, Daniel. A very good message indeed. Daniel Sykes, thank you very much for joining us here and sharing your sight loss story, plus some online safety tips as well, here on RNIB Connect Radio. It's time on RNIB Connect Radio to talk movies. Yes, being the host of Sounds of the Silver Screen, it's actually about time, after about 3 years, to do a demo of an app relating to movies. The app I'm talking about is Letterboxd, is what we're going to look at today. Now, this app is kind of, if you imagine, a bit of a review app and a social network app for movie lovers. You get a bit of everything, because you can track and rate the movies you have watched, but you can also follow your friends on there and see what movies they have been watching and things like that. So there's a social element to it, as well as tracking the films you are watching. And you guessed it, there are stats involved, so of course I've jumped onto it. Let's take a look. We'll take a look at the sections at the bottom of the screen and go through them individually first.
Selected. Popular. Button.
We've got popular, and you can look at the section.
Selected. Films. Button. 1 of 4.
So currently selected is films, so you can look at popular films.
Reviews. Button. 2 of 4.
You've got reviews.
Lists. Button. 3 of 4.
Various lists. You can popular list. You can select and browse.
Journal. Button. 4 of 4.
Then you've got a journal. So let's look at films.
Popular this week. Spider-Man. Brand New Day. Button.
So you can look at popular films.
The End of Oak Street. Button. The Odyssey. Button.
Definitely a film on my list I want to watch.
The Invite. Button.
And you can browse through quite a lot of films.
Obsession. Button.
That's another one I want to watch.
The Last House. Button. Don't Say Good Luck. Button. The Drama. Button.
So these are the few films you can browse, and if you tap on that film, you can get a few more bits of detail on about it. Let's go for one of them.
The Last House. The Invite. The Odyssey. The Odyssey. But back. 173 minutes. The Odyssey. 173 minutes. The Odyssey.
So there we go. Tells you the duration of it.
2026. Button. Directed by Christopher Nolan. Button. The Odyssey. Button. Play trailer. Button.
You can access the trailer as well.
Defy the Gods. Button. Play Defy the Gods. Button. Odysseus, the legendary king of Ithaca, embarks on a long and perilous journey home following the Trojan War. Throughout his voyage, he is forced to confront the whims of gods, mythological monsters, and trials that stretch both his cunning and his humanity to the breaking point.
That's a description.
Ratings. Average rating 4.4 stars.
Then you've got an average rating. Lower than I expected.
Odysseus, the defy rate 1 star. 5. Rate. Log. Review. Add to list plus more. Button.
So here is where you can do various things to that movie. As you've heard, they've got a few options. You can rate it, you can log it, you can add to a list. I'm not going to do any of it because I haven't actually watched it yet, but it is on the list for me to watch.
An Odyssey of formats. Track every way you've seen the Odyssey. Start now. Button. Remove ads. Button. At Lovin' Max advertisement. Where to watch.
Then you've got where to watch, which is quite useful.
Showtimes plus tickets. Screens near you. Selected. Cast. Button. Heading. You've got 1 of 5.
You've got a few unlabeled items there, and then you can look at the cast.
Crew. Button. Heading. Look 2 of 5.
Look at the crew.
Details. Button. Heading. 3 of 5.
Details.
Genres. Button. Heading. 4 of 5. Releases. Button. Heading. 5 of 5. Matt Damon. Odysseus. Tom Holland. Telemachus. Anne Hathaway. Penelope.
And it's very accessible. You can look at who plays who, so it's really good, to be fair.
Back. Button. The Odyssey. Button.
So that's kind of the popular screen.
Select it. Search. Button.
Then you've got the search. That's fairly self-explanatory.
Add a film. Button. Search field. Is editing. Empty list. Profile link to Silver Screen 96. Add a film. Heading.
Then you can add a film to your profile.
profile linked to Silverscreen 96. Button.
Silverscreen 96. Of course, that's going to be my name.
Search empty list. Cap Q. Quebec. Keyboard hidden. Empty list. Activity. Button.
Activity. Fairly self-explanatory again, but I'll show you what we've got.
Activity. Heading. Filters. Button.
Filter your activity.
Selected. Friends. Button. You. Button. Selected. You. 2 of 3.
I don't have any friends, so I'm going to look at my activity.
Incoming. Button. No activity. Forget about it. Popular. Button. Search. Button.
So no activity, because I haven't actually added a film yet, or at least I did, but it was a few months ago when I watched Project Hail Mary, but that's not showing up, so I guess the filters might sort that out.
Add a film. Selected. Activity. Profile. Button. Profile. Button.
Profile. Let's take a look at that.
Settings. Settings. Button.
So, of course, you've got the settings section.
Silverscreen 96. Heading. More. Button. Selected. Profile. Button. Diary. Button. 2 of 4.
Profile. So, diary, if I log my movies and things like that, this is where you'll find them.
Lists. Button. 3 of 4. Diary. Lists. Button. 3 of 4.
So you have lists. You can create whatever lists you want in whatever way you wish. It's quite nice that way. You can be customizable. But you also have...
Watch list. Button. 4 of 4.
Your watch list. So you can actually track the films you want to watch and put them on your watch list to not forget. Because if you're anything like me, you'll say you want to watch a film and you'll forget about it. And that's what always seems to happen, which is a bit annoying.
Recent activity. Rewatched, liked and rated Project Hail Mary 4.5 stars.
There you go.
More activity. 1 star. 5 star. Remove ads. Button. At Loving Max and Films, 1/1 this year.
So films 1 out of 1 this year. As you can tell, I don't watch as many films as people think.
Diary. 1/1 this year.
1 diary entry.
Reviews. 0.
0 reviews.
Lists. 0.
0 lists.
Watch list. 0.
0 on to watch list.
Likes. 1.
1 likes, which was Project Hail Mary.
Tags. 0. Following. 0. Followers. 0. Stats. Upgrade 2.
You can upgrade to see stats, more detailed stats, of course.
Popular. Button.
And you are back to the tabs along the bottom of the screen. They are not explicitly listed as tabs, but they are there. And in short, that is a brief overview of the Letterboxd app. I have added reviews, and that process seems fairly accessible. I've had no major issues, so it can be done. I've not faced too many accessibility issues. To be honest, this app is actually quite accessible. The setup process did involve, mind you, some use of screen recognition, which you maybe need to be mindful of. But it wasn't impossible. It was doable. So it's not a tricky one. Just keep in mind that if there's something that you're trying to find during the setup process when you create an account or double tap on and it's not showing up, or it's not reacting, you may need to turn on the screen recognition either in VoiceOver settings or through your router. Once you've set up and do whatever you need to do with screen recognition, I have found that after that, everything else is very much accessible and very well labeled, which is always nice to see because you never know sometimes if the developers put in accessibility to begin with intentionally or if it's just unintentionally, but, you know, fantastically accessible. It's very good if you like your films. Then do check this out. You can't add TV shows onto it. It's just movies. I don't know if they're going to add TV shows or not. There are probably other apps for this. If you do want something that does both movies and TV shows, IMDb is your friend to look at. And that's an app we will probably take a look at later on in time here on Tech Talk, because I also use that. But for now, that is the brief look at Letterboxd. Let me know what you think. You've heard my name. You feel free to follow me there. And on occasion, I will probably post a movie that I have watched. And so you can have a look what I watched and what I think of them.
And that is it from us for another week. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us. If you've got any questions or comments or anything that you want to share, let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk is that all-important email address you need. We'll be back with you, same time, same place, next week. But from me, Callum Stoneman, Hubert Pavalkovich, Jackie Brown, and Natalie Curran, bye for now.
Goodbye.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.